Kia ora. Welcome to this evening's session on ACC in rural New Zealand. Firstly, welcome and thank you to Dr. Millie Hanlon, an occupational physician based in Wellington, who currently works as a medical advisor for ACC, and Tim Robertshaw, an engagement and performance manager who works for ACC and is based in the Hawke's Bay. We would love a very interactive session this evening and are happy to answer generic questions and any specific ones related to cases from your own clinical work. Please put them in the chat. And Ralston, a rural hospital medicine specialist based in Taupō, who I'm excited to say has agreed to help out with our webinars, will put them to the speakers throughout the session. So great to have you on board, Ralston, and thank you very much. So our evening tonight is supported by the Section of Rural Health, Department of General Practice, University of Otago, and is endorsed for 1 hour of CME by the Rural New Zealand College of General Practitioners. I will now hand over to Tim and Millie, and we'll go from there. Thank you.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for having us. I guess as is normal for these things, we have a set of slides which we'll work through just to give order and some shape to what we're going to talk about. But as Lucinda says, very happy to have questions about anything within the whole gamut, really, of ACC and what we do. So we thought we might start with a little bit of an overview around ACC and about who we are. So I'll hand over to Millie, first of all, to do a bit of an introduction of herself.
Hello, kia ora. My name is Millie Hanlon. I'm an occupational physician. I did come through general practice. I was a GP for a few years and then saw the light, as they say, and did some extra training and moved across. Unfortunately, I haven't practiced general practice in New Zealand, so it's a bit difficult sometimes for me to understand some of the process stuff, particularly around the software that you use in practices and in hospitals to understand where some of the issues are. But I'll do my best. And if there are any questions that Tim or I can't answer, we can definitely find out for you at some point. Yeah.
And I'm Tim Robertshaw. I'm what's called at ACC an engagement and performance manager. And there's about 17 of me around the country. We work in the part of ACC that's focused on contracting and health procurement. And our job really is to be the link between the people in our areas and ACC. So, and our roles around contract management and relationship management and problem solving for people. I'm based in Hastings, and my area is Hawke's Bay and Tairawhiti. So just a sort of a little bit about ACC. You'll probably know most of this. ACC's been around since the 1st of April 1974. There's been five major bits of legislation that either brought us into being or have changed us a bit. But at its core, ACC remains, or the ACC scheme remains, a 24-hour no-fault scheme. So it doesn't matter how irresponsible you've been in general, you're still covered by the scheme. We cover all New Zealand citizens and residents, as long as people are what's called ordinarily resident in New Zealand. And that's really about not leaving the country or intending to leave the country for more than 6 months. If you head off for a couple of weeks in the Cook Islands and fall off onto their magnificent scooters, then when you come back to New Zealand, you will be covered by ACC. Your health insurance or reciprocal health agreements will cover you for your treatment while you're overseas, but ACC will pick that up when you come back. And we also cover all visitors to New Zealand who are injured in New Zealand. The funding of ACC is, most of you know, it's around levies, and the four main bank accounts are the ones you can see on the screen there. So the motor vehicle fund is funded when you pay for your motor vehicle license. Most of that money comes to ACC and we put it in that bank account. And then if people are injured in or by a motor vehicle on a public road, we pay for that injury, the costs associated with that out of that account. The employer's account, all employers pay ACC levies, and it's risk rated. So some employers in riskier types of vocation pay more, but it's a certain number of dollars per $100 worth of salary that are paid. That goes into the employer's account and it pays for injuries that happen to people in the workplace. The earner's account, when you pay your PAYE tax, the IRD collects about an extra 0.07%, which they give to us, and that goes into the earner's account, which covers people who are employed or self-employed for injuries that don't occur in the workplace. And then the fourth main account is the supplementary account, which is the only one that comes from general government taxation. And that really covers earning people not injured in a motor vehicle. So most commonly retired people, unemployed people, or children who are not injured in a motor vehicle, because the accounts take precedence in the order that they are in there. So that's a brief overview of ACC, and Millie's going to talk now about what is covered by ACC.
We have to have a clinically definable injury that is the result of an identifiable accident, and that will give you cover under the ACC scheme. All sounds very straightforward, but obviously doesn't always end up that way. If you could move on to the next slide, please, Tim. This is my favourite slide out of the whole presentation because it's got all these abbreviations. So these are the different types of injuries that we cover. So I thought I'd give you a little, it's all very obvious, but I thought I'd give you a little demonstration for each. So PICBA is a physical injury caused by accident. So those are usually the most straightforward, where there's a clear and direct link between the accident and the injury that you sustained. And you have to fulfill that it's more likely than not that that accident has been the cause of the injury. So the very simple one is somebody's up a ladder painting the roof or the house and falls off the ladder and fractures their arm. So clearly the identifiable injury is a fractured arm, and the identifiable accident was he fell off the ladder. So it does, of course, get a little bit more complex for a physical injury caused by accident when there's some discrepancy or there's some other underlying issues underneath that may be impacting on the state of the patient. So you can look at some of those cases where there might be underlying osteoarthritis. The patient's a bit older. They sustain a meniscal tear to their knee. And then that question of whether the injury, whatever it was, whether it caused the accident becomes a bit harder to tease apart. The things that we would look at then would be the mechanism of accident. If it was somebody turned over in bed and then suddenly they've got a meniscal tear, clearly that doesn't really have a sufficient force to cause a meniscal tear. And then we would see that it's on the basis, it was happened on the background of osteoarthritis. Perhaps the meniscal tear is maybe on the lateral compartment, not the medial compartment, and all those things that point to it being more degenerative. Then we would say, no, there's no clear causal link. Or it might be that the patient was getting out of a car, stood up, and then slipped, they put their foot down and sustained a torsional twist to their knee that was weight-bearing. There's a clear acute medial meniscal tear that would fit more with being an acute trauma, and then we'd look to cover that. They tend to be a little bit more contentious. I guess the other area where that really comes out is in the shoulder rotator cuff tears, because there's such a high proportion of the population who have asymptomatic rotator cuff tears, particularly in the over 50s, that it can be quite hard to work out whether a specific accident caused it. And what we'd really like to do in those cases is to image both shoulders to see what the other one looks like. But that's not always the best for the patient, and it's expensive and so on. So we don't always get that clarification. So we have to do what we can with the information that we've got. So that's PICBA. So moving on to MICSA. So rather than a physical injury, this is a mental injury, and this is a mental injury caused by sexual abuse. So we're looking at a whole range of mental injuries or diagnoses. And in fact, a mental injury, I think we've got it in a later slide, but just briefly, it's defined in the Act, the ACC Act, as being a clinically significant behavioural, cognitive or psychological dysfunction. If you have a mental injury, then you've got to fulfill that criteria. A MICP is another mental injury, but it's one caused by a physical injury. So that would be, for example, somebody who's in a really nasty car accident and then gets a diagnosis of PTSD relating to that accident, because of course it's based on the injury, the physical injury that they received in the actual accident. Then my favourite is the wormy, I like to call it, which is a work-related mental injury. That will be somebody who gets a mental injury as defined under the Act whilst they're at work. So a good way to illustrate this is the case of a pharmacy that gets held up at gunpoint for whatever it is that the gun holder wants. And the pharmacy technician who's behind the counter ends up with a diagnosis of PTSD resulting from that episode while she was at work in the pharmacy. However, the customer who was waiting for her prescription to be filled gets PTSD, but it's not covered by ACC because that customer was not at work when it happened. That's the way it rolls. I have seen some other work-related mental injuries, often and more commonly these days, it's related to stress and whether people knew about the stress and what's happened since then. I did see one patient once who had a wormy, and he'd been working in a steel workshop and a big heavy girder fell and crushed one of his work colleagues who died at the scene. And he had quite a significant PTSD from that. So that was also a wormy. So moving on, the work-related gradual process injuries. If you're interested and you want to head to the ACC website at some point after this, or in fact, if you Google my name and ACC, you'll come up with some provider videos, we call them, and I starred in two of them, and one of them was about work-related gradual process injury. It explains it quite nicely in there, and I think I talk about Steve, and Steve is a carpet layer, and he presented with prepatellar bursitis, and he got cover for a work-related gradual process injury. There are three things in the legislation that you have to fulfill to get a work-related gradual process injury. The first of them is whether the tasks or the work environment caused or contributed to the injury. The second is whether it's more likely that the injury caused by those tasks or the type of work they were doing rather than the injury that they've got being caused by other things they were doing in their everyday life. And the third part of that legislation is if the worker is known to be at greater risk because of the type of work or work environment than others who don't work in that work type. So in the case of Steve and his prepatellar bursitis, he's a carpet layer, so he spends quite a lot of time on his knees. And so we know that the tasks that he does in that position have more than likely caused or at least contributed to the injury. He doesn't get on his knees when he's not at work. It's more likely that injury was caused at work, not outside of work. And we know that people who spend a lot of time on their knees are at greater risk because of what they do. So he would have got a covered injury from that. And then TI is treatment injury. So the legislation states that a treatment injury is when somebody sustains an injury that's been afforded to them by a registered health professional. And in the law, in the Act, there's a definition of what a health practitioner is. And sometimes that changes or it gets updated. And at the moment, acupuncturists, I think, are still not registered health practitioners. And so you can't get an ACC-covered injury from getting acupuncture. But it covers all the things like doctors, nurses, midwives, osteopaths. I wonder if psychologists must be covered. Anyway, less important for that one. I think it also covers negligence. If something didn't happen, then that's a treatment injury. Or something didn't happen that should have happened, then that becomes a treatment injury. So I guess a straightforward example would be somebody who's having a hysterectomy and whilst they're in surgery, their bowel gets perforated. So the perforated bowel becomes the treatment injury because they sustained it during treatment. Also, as part of the treatment injury, we look at consequential injuries. A consequential injury would be somebody who, for example, broke their leg and then couldn't move and then got a DVT from the prolonged immobilization. So the leg fracture would be the normal physical injury caused by accident, and then the DVT is a consequential injury subsequent to the fractured leg. And there are, in fact, there was a very interesting case that we might get to if we have time, about somebody who got a PE and has lodged as a treatment injury from a DVT that they got whilst they were walking. It was a half marathon, but they were walking, not running. Well, we can unpick that a little bit later, but those are the kind of things that are looked at under the treatment injury. And then the last one is our newest type, which is maternal birth injuries. So the legislation came into being from the 1st of October 2022. And there's actually a specified list which is available on the website if you haven't seen it. There's an actual list of injuries that we will cover under this legislation, and they include things like anterior wall prolapse, posterior wall prolapse or uterine prolapse, coccyx fractural dislocation, levator revulsion, and so on and so forth. It doesn't cover the more normal injuries associated with childbirth that you might get.
Say, Millie, say it with that maternal birth injuries one. I can think of a woman I've just had in this week, actually, who's got an anterior wall prolapse and is seeing pelvic physio and things.
Yep.
I don't actually know if anyone's lodged ACC. Didn't enter my mind, actually, because we don't often see them much now with midwifery and being involved. So what would you actually cover if that, what would be the benefit of lodging ACC for maternal birth injuries?
Sometimes there is no benefit, but often it allows the patient to get the support that they need. Or if they need any support, it will allow them to get that through ACC funded, essentially, or at least part funded.
And just going back to say, are you going to talk about more about the documentation? Say with the work-related mental injury, we'd lodge that on an ACC 45.
Yep.
And then obviously we don't really have these acronyms in our brain.
No, you don't need them.
So on that form, say when you're putting the process, is that where I know there's a box for ticking for gradual process. Is it the same box for the work related? Does it put it in there?
I'm not sure, but it gets filtered out when it hits ACC's big computer. It gets filtered out and somebody looks at it under the work related gradual process or the treatment injury or whatever.
It must come in under the same box.
Yeah. There are specific forms for everything, but you don't have to use them. Like the ACC 18 is the catch-all, so that it should be picked up by AC when it arrives. In terms of maternal birth injuries, people who can lodge them, it is specified, are the GP, obs and gynae specialist, a nurse practitioner, a registered nurse, a urologist, pelvic health physio, a normal physio, chiropractor, osteopath or midwife. But we wouldn't expect to get one from, I don't know. Anyway, you can lodge it if you
I'm not bearing in mind. Okay, thank you.
Okay, next slide, please. Yeah, I think this is just a description of what we cover. So the clinically definable injuries, the things we see very commonly that often just get accepted automatically by ACC. Sometimes it's as quick as the claim being lodged whilst they're with the GP. And by the time they get to reception to pay, that they've got a text on their phone saying we've accepted your injury, because so much of it is done automatically, which is also can be where issues arise, because things slip through or they go through with the wrong coding, and then it takes a little bit longer to work that all out afterwards. Lots of wounds, lacerations, sprains, strains, fractures, traumatic amputations, dislocations, etc. We also cover insect bites and stings, foreign bodies, effects of poisoning. I guess that's an interesting one, particularly if it's self-inflicted, because if it's decided, and usually there's a complex mental injury panel that will decide in tricky cases, if it's a suicide attempt where the person who was attempting was clearly aware of what they were doing and wanted to, then the injury that was sustained will be covered. But the entitlements might not be. They might not be entitled to any earnings-related compensation or things like that, but they'll have all their treatment supported. I have to say, I haven't seen anyone who has not had support in terms of a suicide attempt, so I think it's quite rare. But they do tell us, no, you have to work that one out.
Okay.
Yeah. Next slide.
I'm going to guess that you're utilising AI in those quick...
Yes.
We
get about 2 million claims lodged a year, and they flow through an AI type system. And yes, and that does the initial cut, obviously accepted. And then if you've given us the person's cell phone number, they get the text pretty much straight away. And if not, then it gets sent off to one of several specialist teams to look at cover And that also happens if there's not a, if it's probably a straightforward injury, but there's not enough information on the ACC 45 to determine that. So yes, they head off to specialist teams to then collect a bit more information, or sometimes with the more complex ones, a lot more information before that cover decision is made.
Brilliant.
Yep. So this is just going back a little bit about simple, where the identifiable accident is simple and we get a clear causal link. And of course, the legislation probably still says that it's got to be an external force that causes the injury. But that's changed a bit now with the maternal birth injury legislation, because that's not external.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, next slide. Thanks. And the complex ones, which we've talked a little bit about, mental injury. Actually, this is quite an important point, which confuses many, although it is changing a little bit. The date of injury, which becomes important later down the line in terms of compensation for mental injuries, is the date that the patient first sought help for that. And often we need both medical advice, like from me, and psychology advice from a psychology advisor, who we have lots of, to determine when that date of injury is. And often, particularly in the case of childhood sexual abuse, it can be quite hard to work out, particularly if it was undisclosed at the time. And so what you don't want is somebody in their 30s suddenly disclosing and having a date of injury in their 30s and not being supported with anything prior to that, when clearly there were significant issues going on. I see many cases where we've got the whole childhood notes, including school reports, CAMS involvement, and all that kind of thing, to work out whether the change in behaviour, the things that they were presenting with, acting out, or whatever, it was actually more likely to be related to the sexual abuse that they suffered that wasn't clear at the time. That has changed recently because of a recent ruling in the court in the case of TN. I don't know who TN was, but it was in the case of somebody with a mixer, mental injury caused by sexual abuse, where the date she didn't disclose until much later on, but she applied for compensation for loss of potential earnings. So she said at some point later that she'd never been able to work because the effects of this mental injury on her, but ACC were unable to compensate her because in the legislation, the date of injury was the date that she first sought treatment. So in this ruling in the court, the judge, that in the case of Lopi, where it was quite obvious that there had been a significant impact, we could consider compensating them from the date of their 18th birthday in terms of work-related compensation.
Okay.
Yeah. It's probably a good point to say. I've been at ACC for 3 years, and I have to say I've never met anyone who isn't out to help the patient. It really, sometimes ACC gets a really bad press, and lots of patients have got a horror story about ACC, many of which are probably true, but usually boil down to poor communication or actually a lack of understanding, usually on the patient's side, about what they're actually entitled to. And we're so bound up by the legislation, what we can and can't provide. That's usually where all the mistrust, if you like, comes from in the public eye. And that was just a nice demonstration of how we're always trying to do things for our clients. We call them AC, but they're your patients, to make things better for them and not to disadvantage them. And in actual fact, when I give medical advice, we're often told you mustn't do anything that financially disadvantages the patient. So if, for example, to get weekly compensation, you have to have been earning at the time that you had your injury. If somebody's being paid weekly compensation on one claim, and then the sensitive claim comes out and it's a date of injury from earlier, and then they want to transfer their entitlements to the sensitive claim, you might find that you're disadvantaging them because they might not have been an earner at the time of that earlier injury. And then suddenly you wipe out their compensation. And so they end up on the wins, which doesn't pay as well as the ACC compensation. Mm. So in those cases, we'd say this decision is potentially going to financially disadvantage the client, so we're not going to rule it or however it goes. Mm-hmm. So we are there to help. I promise you of that. Next slide, please, Tim.
Can I just say, right down at the bottom of the slide there, when you're lodging a claim for a mental injury, particularly in relation to sexual abuse, in most cases, when you're filling out the ACC 5, we're expecting the person filling that out to be asking the injured person, is it hurt and how did it happen? But for things like a sensitive claims, we don't expect that. On the ACC 45, there's a read code, which is a sensitive issue. And so that's all you need to put on the ACC 45. The other thing you can do is you can refer your patient to that website there, www.findsupport.co.nz, because that lists every ACC contracted counsellor in the country. And so the person can go, the injured person, the client, patient can go in there and break that list down by geographic region, gender, ethnicity, languages spoken, and other areas worked in, like drug and alcohol, transgender issues, that kind of thing. And so they can then self-select a therapist to work with. And we've got your ACC 45, so we know that there's a claim there. The person can then self-select, and ACC will fund the first dozen or so sessions with that therapist at no cost to the client. Sometimes that's all that the patient wants at that time. But if the person then wants to go on and claim further entitlements like time off work or ongoing therapy, that sort of thing, then there is a more detailed bit of information we get from that therapist who's seeing the client, with the client's permission, of course, that gives us enough information to determine that there was an event that occurred that meets that definition of sexual abuse, and that there is a mental injury of a type that meets the requirements of the Act.
Even actually just knowing coding it a sensitive issue is good, because sometimes I wonder what to put in there.
Yes, yeah.
Great.
Yeah, yeah. I think this is more of what I've already talked about. I think I didn't say in the treatment injury bit, but I probably should have done. The injury that occurs, it has to fulfill the criteria that it isn't a necessary part or an ordinary consequence of treatment. Take, for example, surgery. If you are going for abdominal surgery, you have an incision, but that's a normal part of the operation, which you can't have without. So that's not a treatment injury. If you get a hernia at the site of the incision, that's actually an ordinary consequence, because they look at the stats and who gets what and who doesn't. And so you're unlikely to get a hernia, an incisional hernia, covered if it results from surgery. But something else like the perforation of the bowel whilst you're in the abdomen, that's not an ordinary or necessary part of treatment, so that would be covered. So they can be quite tricky. And in fact, I have a colleague who works just in treatment injury, and he always says treatment injury, it's like an onion. You just have to keep peeling back the layers and layers, and you have to know that it's all right to cry as you do. So sometimes they're just like so complex, you can't believe it.
It's good to know actually that clarification around what might be statistically a expected potential consequence that will not be covered.
Good.
Thanks, Millie. Just to talk about a little bit about, I guess, the services that are available. And rather than spending time going over everything that we do, we thought we would focus on three or four things in particular. Obviously, happy to take questions about anything that we do. A couple of things we thought we'd mention as a start was that there are a couple of services that doctors can make direct referral into. So for a lot of services, if you feel your client needs it, you put that on an ACC 18 or you write to ACC and ask us about that. But concussion service and pain management service, you can refer directly into. The way you would do that would be to go onto the ACC website, which is just acc.co.nz, put in the name of the service you are after, concussion or pain management. You'll get a short list of documents, and one of them is the referral form. You would fill that out. There's links in that form to tell you where to send the form to and who are the suppliers that ACC contracts with to provide those services. So you make your selection, you fill out the form, you send it in, and those processes start. So we contract for concussion and for pain management services. And the people who hold those contracts are required to have a multidisciplinary team to provide a wraparound service to that client. So they'll have allied health, they'll have psychology, they'll have access to specialist pain management or specialists in the concussion area to work with the client. And that team actually designs the program for the client and works through that with the client and with the family. If you've got a concussion case and it's a young sports guy and the family's really keen for him to get back on the rugby field or whatever sport it is, then there's also an education role for those teams in terms of trying to set expectations and give education to families around expectations for people. The entrance criteria are fairly straightforward. So for concussion, there has to be a suspected traumatic brain injury, there has to be an accepted ACC claim, and there has to be some ongoing symptoms and some risk factors. The person's got ongoing symptoms and they work in a highly academic, the risk factor there, of course, is that it's if the concussion's not well dealt with, then it's going to delay the return to work. Pain management, similar, there has to be an accepted claim. The person has to have had that pain for more than 3 months, or there has to be a suspected complex regional pain syndrome developing. So the idea is that they are around both of the services, that they early intervention, but the pain one does have that kind of that expectation that that pain will have continued for a period of time, therefore making it perhaps an unusual pain presentation.
I should probably point out here that ACC don't cover pain because pain is a symptom. It's not a physical injury. They do cover CRPS, complex regional pain syndrome, types 1 and 2, but that has to be diagnosed officially by a competent person, which is either a pain specialist, orthopedic surgeon's count, and or occupational physicians, with experience. But ACC does support pain. They don't cover it, but they do support it if it's linked to a covered injury.
Yes, good point, Millie. It has, the pain has to relate to a covered injury of the type that Millie's talked about.
Can I just ask around the concussion? You said something about high academic or something. Can you just clarify that point again for me? So obviously the concussion's got to be impacting on their ability to function or achieve something. If you had someone who was not working but had concussion from a TBI, are they not going to get under?
I was just plucking an example about what a risk factor might be. Yes, so people can access either of these programs irrespective of whether they are at work or not. In fact, most ACC programs aren't dependent on whether a person is in employment at the time of their injury or not. Probably the only one who is the vocational rehabilitation service, which Millie's going to talk about in a short while.
Okay, cool, thanks.
ICP MSK, you might have heard of this, Integrated Care Pathways Musculoskeletal. So this is a program that ACC has been developing over a number of years, probably 4 or 5 years now, and that went to tender last year. And the idea behind it is about partnering with suppliers to provide wraparound services for clients. It's about getting ACC administrative decisions out of the way of clinical pathways. To give an example, the first type of injury we looked at was ACL injuries, and that we had a pilot in Christchurch around it. Because we realised people with ACL type injuries, they'll go to the GP, they'll go to the physio, they'll have a scan, they'll see a specialist, they'll have surgery, they'll have post-operative rehab. And so ACC was funding all of these individual services that weren't joined up in any way. And so the pilot program looked at, why don't we just give this client to a supplier who can provide all of those services and will care about making a good referral and will care about measuring that there's a good outcome, but actually we'll just leave the supplier to get on and do the right thing, follow the best clinical pathways for that person. And that proved beneficial. It achieved a higher level of or better outcomes than a control group. It's relatively financially neutral for ACC. We're still paying for those services, but we're just paying one person in a lump sum bulk kind of way rather than trying to engage with a whole lot of different people. That service has come into place over the last year or so. And ACC's looking at and very focused around some specific musculoskeletal type injuries to shoulders, knees, and lower back, I think it is. But ACC's now looking also at what other types of service that it provides might be better provided through this type of service offering with a more wraparound approach. The other service we thought we would highlight is rongoa, which is traditional Māori healing approaches. So ACC's wanted to provide funding for traditional Māori healing approaches, but technically to do so requires a change to our legislation, which we haven't been able to push across the board yet. But so what we're doing is we are currently funding it as a social rehab intervention. And part of that is that we are gaining information and knowledge as we do that, and to be able to then go to MB, who are our policy wing when it comes to the government, to then perhaps formally get this under our legislation. In essence, anybody can apply for ACC for funding for rongoa. Most people find their own practitioner. Practitioners register with ACC and have a sort of a small schedule of things that they can charge ACC for. But there's a lot of feedback. We're in the early days of collecting information, but there's a lot of feedback already that rongoa is being a beneficial adjunct to other treatments in terms of people's recoveries.
Yeah, exciting. Forward thinking ACC.
We don't often get called that, but we'll take it. Very good. And now we're just going to head back to Millie now to talk a bit about recovery at work and about medical certification.
Of course, as an occupational physician, here I am best placed to talk about recovery at work. So recovery at work, there's been a bit of a drive quite recently in ACC to encourage people to recover at work. There's loads of good evidence to support it. In the UK, there was, you've probably heard of Dame Carol Black, who was commissioned to write a report, and she did a massive, she's a rheumatologist actually, by background, not an OP, but she did a great report. And the finding of it was that good work is good for you, which actually sums it up pretty well. All her research and time came out with that one slogan, which is pretty good. If we get people who are in jobs that they are good at, that they enjoy, trying to get them to get back to work from an injury, it's important to keep them engaged. So staying connected is good for everything, for their physical and mental well-being. It can definitely increase their confidence and their independence. There's evidence showing it can lead to shorter recovery times. It's usually better financially, because if you are participating in any hours at work, you can usually earn, you can usually get up to 100%, because ACC will, of course, fund 80%. But if they're in work, the employers will usually top it up to 100%. There's that good work is good for you. And actually, by allowing the patients to self-direct a bit more and remain engaged, they feel that they have more autonomy over their recovery, and then it's quicker and better, and they feel much more engaged and the results are better. On the website, which is actually quite good, the ACC website, there's loads of quick guides, and one of them, there's a guide to help you talk with your employer, because what we hear quite a lot, and we get a lot of feedback, particularly the GPs, saying that the patients come in to see them and say that they can't go back to work until they're fully fit, because that's what their employer has told them. And so they want a sick note, a medical certificate that says they're fully unfit. Well, that doesn't help anyone, really. But this guide does give you a few hints about how to phrase things, what you might like to bring up with your employer. And it can be quite useful for you to have in your surgeries, if you're GPs, just as a starting guide to help them on that pathway.
Can I just ask around that? Because I certainly get that in my clinical practice. Yeah. And I don't know how to talk to someone or learn this. So what I say to my patients is that actually it's about trying to see what you can do, not what you can't do. And what I'm going to put on this form is what you can do. And then it's up to your boss and ACC to work out what you can do at work. And your boss actually now, if you are fit to do some work, it, the expectation is that they should find them something, isn't it?
Like they. It is.
And then I say, if they can't find you something, then you'll be off anyway. Is that?
Yes.
Which is often what happens.
Yeah. But at least.
But that is a good
trying,
approach, yeah.
Because it's amazing actually how many people do want to go back to work, but their boss is a bit obstructive. I suppose there's a bit of a fear in the workplace too, that if someone's not fully fit and then something goes wrong, they might be liable.
I think they worry that they're going to end up paying somebody else to do that job, and then they're paying on top, and there's all sorts of things. It's quite, I don't want to harp back to the UK at all, but it's such a different environment here compared to there, because New Zealand is full of lots of small businesses who employ very few people. And so when one of those workers is missing, it has such an impact on the output of that business that I can fully understand where it comes from, this reluctance to find them light duties, as it were. Yes, but I also come from a military background where a lot of my sick parades in the mornings was dealing with soldiers who just had a bit of a cold, who didn't want to actually run the fitness tests because they might fail it, or they were feeling just a bit ropey and they'd get a bad time and it would look, and they weren't allowed to not run it just by saying they had a cold. So they had to come and see the doctor, who could tell them, yes, you have a cold, you don't have to do the run today, you'll probably be all right in 3 days to do the run. From that prescriptive side, being completely prescriptive about what you can and can't do can actually sometimes be helpful in these situations. And the other point, I think, is I always joke about, especially as an OP, you should never sign a fully unfit, this client's fully unfit, unless they're lying intubated on ICU, because there's always something that they can do. So really, it is up to the employer to find something. And if the employer can't, that's fine. But the other thing about, if you sign that they're fit for something, fit for some work, it allows ACC, the ACC side of things, to then move into action. Because if you're saying they're not fit to do anything, then they're not fit to do any kind of rehabilitation or the stay at work program or anything like that. So it can actually be a barrier. And so sometimes explaining that to the patient with Lucinda's caveat of, and if they haven't got anything, you'll be off work anyway, which is often what happens, it then does allow them to access the rehab programs.
It's similar to the MSD forms, isn't it? If you write them right off, then they get no more help. And then no one's further ahead in 3 months' time, are they? It really is counterproductive, I think. I do try and say to them, actually, look, then that allows us to get you more help and get you back and get into rehab. And the physio programs that they do in terms of the graduated return to work programs are amazing. Like, you get a lot of detail on those.
Yeah, you do. Very prescriptive. And they can also, physios and some OTs can do some useful FCEs, functional capacity evaluations, where if there's any issue about what somebody can do functionally, particularly if they're in a manual type job, the physio or OT will take them through a range. You usually do it in a gym, sometimes you can do it in the workplace, to see how many times they can lift that box that weighs 10 kgs to waist height. So there's a really specific outcome that allows them to say, yes, they're fit to do that job, or no, they're not, or they are fit to do it, but they're restricted time-wise because they'll fatigue after this because of their injury. And that can be a really useful tool that can be accessed under the vocational staff.
Functional capacity assessment, did you say?
Evaluation, FCE.
Evaluation.
Yep. But that's it, exactly. Yep. And also under these programs, the physios or OTs can go into the workplace and look at exactly what the patient needs to do, and then work with the employer, work with the patient. They can set up a functional program in the gym to mimic what they do in the workplace so that they can be functionally ready, that can get them back into work quicker. Yeah. They do a kind of a job mapping process where they work out what's needed to do, and then they work on those bits. So other bits might be a bit slower to recover, but the work readiness comes sooner.
I'd be interested to see in the team that are here, because I always work rurally. Obviously, these programs are potentially easier to access if you live in an urban centre where you have a higher density of physios and occupational therapists and OPs even. Do you guys look at equity access in rural New Zealand compared to urban New Zealand in terms of, or delays in terms of requests by, say, GPs or rural hospital doctors to accessing these programs? Have you ever looked into that?
On a case-by-case basis, I'm the escalation point across a whole range of different services. Case owners are are trying to get a client into one of those services and there's delays, then they get escalated to me, and then it's my job or one of my colleagues' jobs to talk to that, our contracted suppliers around that, and get things working again. Vocational rehab in particular is pretty well supported nationally. It's not an area that we get a lot of escalations about at all. It's obviously a contract that pays fairly well, and suppliers are interested in doing it. One of my areas is Te Rāwhiti, of course, which goes right up the East Coast. And we have the occasional issue with delays in getting someone that service, but surprisingly few, really.
And I think once you get onto a contracted service as a patient, then it's up to the service provider to give you that service. Now, I used to travel all over New Zealand to go and do clinics, some of which would be part of either the concussion or the pain management contract. But I'd find a lot, on my travels, I'd find lots of physios and OTs and VOC consultants as well who would travel out to see the patients. They wouldn't necessarily be expected to come into the centre. It would be done out there. But I guess the issue is for those patients of yours who are not on those services, sometimes there can be a delay. I think there were a couple of written questions that kind of covered some of those questions as well that we should talk about at some point.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So in terms of vocational rehabilitation, there's lots of different things. The main one that's the most straightforward for you guys is the stay at work program. So that's for somebody who's got a job at the time that they were injured and then trying to help them get back to that work itself. If it doesn't work, they could then get put on a back to work, which is back to any job, usually a job of the same thing. It might be something different. But if they're not in work at the time that they were injured, they won't get a stay at work program because they weren't in a job to stay at. Now, I did have a little look into this because I spent, as Lucinda and Rolston both know, I spent some time at the GP conference in Wellington on the ACC stand a couple of weekends ago. It had been recommended for us on the stand to inform GPs that they can refer directly for a stay at work program. And in fact, when I looked into it, I don't think you can. You can tick on the ACC 18 that the stay at work or the vocation, I don't know what the wording is. There's a drop down, or is a work recovery program, something like that. Is that required? And you can tick yes. And that will signal to ACC that they need to get a stay at work program in. So you can do that on an ACC 18, or you can free text into an ACC 18. But what you can't do is absolutely make the referral, but you can contact a local vocational rehab supplier in your area who will do the referral on your behalf. Because before anything starts, ACC have to agree that they will spend that money on this patient. So okay. It's not really a direct referral, but it is a more direct route to get there rather than trying to contact the case manager, if there is one at ACC, to implement, etc., etc. So there are shortcuts. And when I looked at some of the other things that was recommended, it might be on the next slide, that ACCs can refer directly to, it's the same thing. You have to do it on the ACC 18 in the free text, or ask the recovery team for those things that you have identified that the patient's going to need. And that can be things like psychology input, the home help, nursing services, or even a vocational rehab review with an OP. Which are widely underused, but really it's because nobody knows about them or understands how beneficial they can be. The vocational rehab reviews are usually done by an occupational physician, and often they're used when treatment or rehabilitation is stalled. They can be a really good way because the OP will have usually an hour or more with that patient, which you probably never get, and you can actually unpick some of the issues that are going on. If there are specific barriers that are causing the problem or causing the lack of progress, you can identify those and then raise them to ACC to help overcome them. And they can be quite enlightening, and there's always a thorough report at the end of them. And you can also ask specific questions for the OP to consider during those. But you can't approach an OP directly, you have to ask ACC to do it for you. Is what
so
they
these
mean
the
by
ones that
referral.
Come back with they could consider this job? Or the
no, that's a initial medical assessment, an IMA, where they do a similar kind of assessment and they are supposed to comment about the barriers to rehabilitation, if there are any. So the VRR is more where you're not quite sure where to go. You can see something needs to happen because they're not back to where they were. They're not ready for that work. They can do this work, that work, assessment, the IMA, but they need something else. That's probably quite a good one to remember.
I think it's official. I've never requested one of those because I see that doc and I'm like, no, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Maybe I will.
I'm sure. Maybe. Yes, onto medical certification. So we have talked a little bit about this. I think there's a couple of useful things. I think a little reflection and a reminder every now and again about what you're actually doing on a medical certificate is probably a helpful tool to have in your toolbox. They're really important from my side of the fence because often that's where we get most of the information and often there isn't enough on it for us to be able to determine whether the client or the patient was actually incapacitated or not, because sometimes some of that information is missing. So if I could implore people filling out medical certificates, it's to include as much relevant information as possible. But it's not rocket science. You're talking about what they can do or what they specifically should avoid because of their injury. Yeah. So anyway, it's what we use for weekly compensation to get started. That's why it has to be continuous, because if it stops for any prolonged length of time, then the compensation will stop, which obviously the patient gets quite upset about. We did have a little chat about this in our pre-meet yesterday about what's required when you fill out a medical certification, and the physically examining the patient came up for discussion. And actually, it's not always relevant. If, for example, your patient came to see you having just been to the physio who'd done a full examination or examination of the relevant bit, for example, the knee, and had specified what the function was associated with that, there's no point really in you doing another exam. And it was it's the same on IC sensitive claim patients. I don't physically examine them. I'll make some comment about their mental state usually, but they don't need a physical exam. Mm-hmm. So use your common sense about that. Yep. Or if they've just been to an orthopedic surgeon, or they're just about to go, or they've got a point with a physio tomorrow where you know they're going to be moved about and asked to do various things, it's not always necessary to do a physical exam. And I think, Lucinda, yesterday you had a question about...
all my flaws came out, didn't it? I was very honest. And I said, I don't necessarily always examine people because often we'll do these over the phone.
Yeah.
Now with the state of primary care. And then we talked about retrospectively dating. So I said sometimes it'll expire on Friday and I'm talking to them on Monday and I'll always retrospectively backdate them. But you said that didn't need to happen because if it's less than a week, then it will roll over. But if it's longer than a week, then you want some explanation around why there's that difference in the dates around on the RKT, don't you?
Yeah, and I was thinking about this because up in the ACC18, you have to fill in the dates that they're incapacitated or what they're fully unfit or fit for some work or fit for all duties.
Yeah.
And that's when you put the retrospective date in, but the signature at the bottom should be the date that you complete the form. And then if there's a massive discrepancy, you could make some comment.
Okay. Mm.
But then, of course, there comes the issue for people, particularly in the sensitive claim world, who've been off for ages but haven't seen anyone. And then they come in to see the GP and say, oh, ACC's told me I need basically an incapacity certificate for the past 5 years or 15 years or 20 years, as it is sometimes. And then you'll get one that said, the patient's asked me to do this because you wanted it. Or you'll get one given for every 3 months of that period, which then takes up a lot of notes space in the
That's probably how I would have previously attempted to do it. And now my older age, I'd be like, date and the free text. And even actually with the graduated return to work programs that the physio send us, team, we do not need to write every individual date week in there. We can just say, correct me if I'm wrong, as per the graduated return to work program created by, because I used to manually input all those weeks too and say, this date to this date, 5 days, 4 hours. I was like, far out, this is monotonous. You don't need to do that.
Yeah, yep. You don't need to do that.
Either. So if that's a pearl for Monday, there it is.
What's next, Tim? Oh, yeah. There is a Goodfellow unit on certifying work capacity after injury that you can probably access that would be useful CME module for you to do. There's also that MCNZ statement on medical certification that came out last year. Is quite a useful read. It reminds you of those things that I was like hinting at. So it's got to be an accurate reflection, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, and my point would be to make some comment about the function, about why. Sometimes it's not that helpful to read, this is basic, the client's fully unfit because sensitive claim. That doesn't tell me anything. It tells me I've got a sensitive claim. But it would be better to write something like lack of motivation, they're depressed, can't sleep, work would be impossible, something like that to clarify to me, the reader on the other end. Yes. And equally, when I get a request to look at backdated compensation for somebody in the sensitive claim world, sometimes I have to look at 20, 30, 40 years worth of notes, which I'm sure you can imagine is not the easiest task. But sometimes there's no comment at all about work capacity. Sometimes that's relevant because the patient isn't in work. Why would you discuss it? But if there's anything about being at work or how they are, whether they can go out of the house or are they paralyzed by their social anxiety, they can't go to the supermarket because they get triggered, or all those things really help us build the picture, particularly if there's no specific comment about work, which is what ACC want to know in order to pay them later on when they need it.
Okay.
Yep. So that's my top tip.
Obviously,
Tim.
That's just going into the note body, in the body of your notes when you're seeing someone say about their sensitive issue.
Yes.
Yep. Put something about the impact on life and what specifically it is and the consequence of that
symptom
on the impact on life, functional impairment. Okay. Great.
So, sometimes it's obvious they'll be like, was in hospital, suicide attempt. Think, okay, they clearly couldn't have worked at that point. But unable to work at the moment doesn't tell me why they were unable to work. And it might be because actually, I don't know, they had a baby yesterday or something, rather than actually they were crippled by the functional effects of their mental injury and couldn't leave the house to get into work if they had a job.
Cool. And we just had a couple of slides to finish with, really, around communicating with ACC. We've talked about the ACC 18. That's a great way to tell us bits of information or to ask us to contact you. We have a contact centre. I know they take a long time to answer the phone, but we're working on that. But I would also say that if you're trying to work with ACC and having difficulty getting a response or don't feel that you're getting a satisfactory response, then the ME in your area, the engagement and performance manager for ACC, is your escalation point. You might have spotted that my contact details are on the first slide or the second slide of this, so I'm very happy to be contacted, and I will either pass you on to my colleague who covers your area or manage that myself. Yeah. Don't want people to sit in frustration not knowing how to deal with issues where you don't feel that you're being heard or responded to. Certainly use me as an escalation point. We have a thing called the ACC Provider Update, which is a monthly digest of things that are changing at ACC. It's provider focused, so it's about our services. It'll mention things that are coming up for contract, for tender. It'll mention things, changes that we're making. So if we were, I don't know, in 3 months to be making changes to the concussion service, you would read about it there. And it's a monthly digest. It gives you a paragraph on each thing and a link to follow through. If you don't get that and you're interested in getting that, you can just email at provider.engagement, email address, and ask to be put on the distribution list for the ACC provider update, and you'll start getting that. And the other thing which we've talked about at various times is the ACC website. There's a section here which is on the screen, which is the for providers section. I think it's fair to say that 3 or 4 years ago, I wouldn't have referred anybody here, but there's been a lot of work going into making it a useful website. Millie was talking about those short educational videos about different things to do with what we cover and how to do various things with ACC. So those are found here, and there's a whole lot of stuff around lodging claims, what we will pay for. There's a specific section there on maternal birth injuries and a range of other things. Certainly make use of that. Yes, very good. And yes, that's what we had to say today, but happy to take any questions.
Ralston, have you got any questions? Because there's none in the...
Yeah, there's nothing in the chat. I did have questions, if there was nobody else having any.
Yeah, go for it, yeah. So I'll give you one just in terms of the time factor.
I was more curious about... You were talking about mental injury, work-related mental injury. Have you come across any sort of healthcare workers that have accessed that in terms of the potential mental injury they might have from their work?
Interesting. When I was a provider working on the other side of the fence, I did come across one lady who was a nurse in a practice where one of the GPs had sexually abused some of his patients, young boy patients, and she'd walked in on the end of one and had ended up quite significantly traumatized by the whole thing. And I think I was doing her initial medical assessment or something, but she'd had to leave work, and it was just, the whole thing was quite horrific. And I remember there was a fight because ACC had originally declined her claim, but I think it went to review, and I didn't follow it exactly, but I suspect it did get cover. She's the only one I've actually come across. We did have quite a lot from the ACC side. There was quite a lot going around the time of COVID that was quite interesting. And I have seen one or two cases that have got through as not as mental injuries, but that they got a COVID infection through work because they were a teacher or something at a time. Yeah, no, I haven't seen a huge amount. I have only seen that one in terms of health workers.
That's good to know. I'm just curious.
Yeah, but it's an interesting point.
So as I say, gradual process covers disease and infection as well. Yeah. Farmers with brucellosis and things like that.
Lepto, seen lots of that.
Hearing loss as well.
Yeah. All right. So you could put lepto in under the work-related.
Yes, if you're working
or
farmer,
a meatwork, right? Never thought of...
Yeah, so as long as you work in an industry or a profession where you have exposure, where you're more likely to get that, and it's through your work tasks, then yes, that's a likely or cover.
I feel like there's a whole lot I've potentially been not
missing out on
my patients. Yeah. Maybe I should read those monthly updates.
I think an important point is if you don't know but you suspect or you think, you can always put in a claim and we can always decline it. And you don't have to get overly concerned about whether it should or shouldn't be covered, because ACC can make that decision.
Hmm.
Yeah. In fact, right, ACC will make that decision.
Thank you, Millie and Tim. I think that's a perfect place to stop. Thank you very much, everyone, for coming this evening. Thank you very much, Millie, Ralston, Timmer, for your time this evening. Much appreciated. Thanks for everyone coming, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.